Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're not going to be disappointed. David Cobb will join me in a moment. He ran for president in 2004 under the Green Party banner. 2016, he was Jill Stein's campaign manager. And in our opening part of the interview, he'll talk about what happened in 2016, the voter suppression, the other irregularities that raise important challenges to the credibility and that challenge the Trump-Russia narrative. And in roughly the second portion of our conversation, we're going to talk about his movement workshops to help train progressive activists. The movement school will be in Minneapolis in August and in Phoenix in mid-August. The details are in this conversation. I want to thank Susan Lundgren, George Reeves, Jason Ferguson, and Janet Price. They're subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast, and they make this program possible. I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and I think you can figure it out from there. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, I'm pleased to welcome the return of David Cobb. He ran for president in 2004 under the flag of the Green Party and helped lead the recount that proved that the election was stolen in Ohio in 2004. And there's more. He managed Jill Stein's campaign in 2016, and now he's conducting seminars about revolution all across the country. World Party's Private Revolution opens the podcast today as David Cobb joins me by Skype from Eureka, California. And I connected with Eureka back, more than 10 years ago when I was hosting a syndicated radio show. And one of my prime affiliates was KGOE in Eureka. And I've made a lot of friends up there, and that's one of the ways that I connected with David Cobb. And he also, I mentioned his work at the national level, but he is a grassroots activist who helped form the group in Humboldt County, which is, I'm looking for the name here, David, it's called Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County. And so you've been working on a myriad of issues at the local level, including election integrity, and at the national level, promoting third-party alternatives to our arcane and corrupt two-party system. David, great to have you with me today.
It is really exciting to see you break out of the kind of corporate media and branching into these mediums where we can continue to have the kind of dialogue that I'm accustomed to with you. So thank you for welcoming me onto this program, and congratulations on having such a program.
Well, David, I've been podcasting for 8 years now after Air America imploded. That was the lefty radio network that produced Al Franken as a senator and Rachel Maddow as a TV host, but that was about it. And from there, I was able to move a lot of my listeners from KGOE and the other radio stations here to the podcast platform. And 8 years later, my audience is 30% offshore, downloads in 70 countries. I'm really thrilled that so many people around the world are looking for an alternative progressive voice. And likewise, I value your contributions to the national dialogue and to really working for progressive change. We're going to talk in a bit about the movement school that you have set up, and I want to alert people in Minneapolis and Phoenix that in August there are going to be these workshops that I'm going to invite you to attend. But David, I want to get your take as the man who ran the Jill Stein Green Party campaign last year and helped us with the partial recounts that surfaced in Michigan and Wisconsin. I want to get your take on this whole Trump-Russia narrative that has taken hold of the corporate media. It is built on anonymous leaks and documents that we haven't seen. There is little public evidence, and we're speaking now on the day that Don Trump Jr.'s emails have been released, which does show some contact with Russian agents or Russian parties. But by and large, I remain skeptical, particularly of the initial charges that Russia hacked the DNC and John Podesta and gave those spoils to WikiLeaks. What's your take?
Well, there's a couple of things, and I'm glad actually that you are remaining skeptical. I hope that your audience is as well. Anytime we are dealing with allegations coming out of the Central Intelligence Agency or the FBI or other apparatus, we should be skeptical. And we could spend the entire rest of our time together outlining the number of occasions in which the CIA has caused us good reason to be skeptical. I'll presume that we don't need to go into that. Instead, we'll focus on the reality that we have no hard evidence at all of Russian collusion or of Russians controlling the election. That's absolutely true. However, we've got lots of circumstantial evidence that does deserve to be investigated. Mm-hmm. And I encourage such an investigation. Even deeper, I want to point something out. The WikiLeaks information of John Podesta's emails, the substantive information there has basically been corroborated. So regardless of how that information got out, I think it's telling to me that rather than talk about the fact that the Democratic National Committee literally colluded with the Hillary Clinton campaign to prevent Bernie Sanders from even having a fair shake in the Democratic Party's primary is not the story. That's factually true.
Yeah.
There is evidence that has been admitted to. There is a lawsuit underway now against the DNC where the DNC lawyers are literally acknowledging that, well, we've got the right to do it. They're not acknowledging that it happened, but they're saying that even if it did happen, we have the legal right to do it. So I just think it's interesting to me, Peter B., that that conversation is not happening, which leads me to this. I wonder if the demonization of Russia is an effort to prevent us from actually looking at the substantive information of what Podesta's emails and the DNC hack actually reveals. We know that such a hack happened, and in some respects, yes, we need to know how it happened. But isn't it important to know factually what that hack revealed?
And just a friendly amendment of your language there, I still refer to it as a leak. Bill Binney, who was the technical director of the NSA, told me last August that this was an insider leak, not a hack. If it had been a hack, the NSA can track the packets and tell you exactly who went in there and when and where they were delivered. And there's now some analysis of the metadata of the Guccifer 2.0 release of the DNC materials. That metadata shows that the transfer rate of 23 megabits per second was too fast to have occurred through a hack, through a remote access of the DNC. Now, I can't, you know, that information has not been certified by any independent analyst, but it's as credible as the fact and evidence-free arguments that sustain the Trump-Russia narrative. And I want to underscore what you said about the contents of Podesta's emails in particular, because they showed that there was ongoing collusion inside the ranks of the DNC to prevent Bernie Sanders from winning, and it showed that the corruption, the pay-to-play of the Clinton Foundation was actually provable. And we have the case of Blumenthal, Sid Blumenthal, was the guy who was on the Clinton Foundation payroll at the same time that he was feeding information to Hillary Clinton at her Secretary of State office. And he brokered a number of deals that really don't pass the smell test. And then there's the Doug Band memo, Bill Clinton Inc., that showed how he was going to grease Bill with $63 million worth of endorsement and speaking deals while Hillary was supposed to be president.
And Donna Brazile and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Again, the content that was revealed, and I appreciate your correction and will accept that friendly amendment and dig a little deeper myself, because you've given me information I did not have, but I want to investigate it. So whether it was a hack or a leak, we actually don't know.
Well, and David, when it comes to manipulation of the election last year, let's deal with the domestic suspects first. Chris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State, ran the biggest voter suppression operation that we know about, the Interstate Cross-Check List.
I did want to get to the substance, but before we even got to the substance of the domestic problems that we now know about, it really is important for your listeners and all of us that are critical thinkers, especially progressives, but all critical thinkers have got to really understand that the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, literally violated its own rules. There was collusion between all aspects of the DNC operation from top to bottom with the Clinton campaign, all because Bernie Sanders and what he represented, a progressive populist uprising within the ranks of the Democratic Party, terrified the neoliberals who actually control that party. So now let's actually turn to 2016 and the election itself. One thing that we do know is that the election system in the United States of America is profoundly susceptible to attacks, to manipulation, and it does in fact start before the first vote is cast. I believe that you are absolutely correct to lift up Interstate Cross-Check, because it literally is an effort to ensure to purge from the rolls not merely folks who should not be on the rolls. No. It is literally an effort to purge poor people and people of color from the rolls, people who historically vote against corporate interest. That is, again, objectively true. The information is there. All one has to do is do internet search on Interstate Cross-Check or the Jill Stein for President website, where we went through in excruciating detail just how horrific Interstate Cross-Check is, specifically as it relates, again, to poor people and people of color. In addition to that, I want to talk about the fact that the U.S. election system and the campaign financing that is associated with it has literally legalized bribery in this country. We have literally turned our elections into auctions. And this was even before the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case. It was horrible. But now it's profane. I mean, I almost don't even have the language to describe how angry and outraged I am about the fact that through independent expenditures, billionaires can literally spend unlimited amounts of money to completely control the narrative. And it doesn't even end with campaign finance, as horrific as that is. Let's also acknowledge, Peter B., that we have a voting system that forces voters to vote against the candidates that they hate rather than for the ones that they want. This single-member district, first-past-the-post, winner-take-all election system that we use is an antiquated way of thinking about elections. It was, in fact, cutting edge 200 years ago when the United States of America was birthed and voting was, mathematics. They were just thinking about how to do it. So good on that. But why can't we use cutting edge voting systems like ranked choice voting or proportional representation or other systems that encourage alternative political parties, alternative voices from being heard? And I'm still not through, Peter B., because we also have to have a scathing indictment of the citizen or the Presidential Debate Commission, which is actually a for-profit corporation created by the Democratic and Republican parties to collude to prevent alternative voices from being heard. And the collusion is real because it many people think mistakenly that the League of Women Voters are the ones who administer presidential elections. It's not true. They once did, They made the mistake of inviting Ross Perot to lay out his vision for America. And whether you like Ross Perot or not, just the idea that debates ought to be a place where, you know, you debate ideas. And the Democratic and Republicans literally took away the presidential debates from them and now enter into a 100-page document agreeing to everything from camera angles to what subjects can be discussed and not discussed. They negotiate and debate who the moderator will be. They literally control that process. And then lastly, I want to really underscore the fact that we have a criminal justice system that is fundamentally racist in this country. And when you tie the ability to vote and the felon disenfranchisement that happens in almost every state save a few in this country, you have a way to prevent many, many people of color and poor people who have criminal justice records from being able to even participate.
And when you put the war on some drugs at the front end of that pipeline, it is a systemic way of marginalizing minority communities and eliminating them from our political processes. And David, I want to focus for a minute here on the recount that you helped supervise in Detroit, in the state of Michigan. And just to recap, Michigan went to Trump by a mere 12,000 votes. In Wayne County, where Detroit is located, there were over 60,000 ballots cast that showed no vote for president. My suspicion is that the scanners were set in order to miss votes for the Democrat, and it just showed up as a wasted vote. And these investigations were shut down by a Republican attorney general who got Republican judges in Michigan to stop the partial recount that was underway. Tell us a little more about that.
So I'm glad that we're actually getting to that, because what I wanted to do in that prior segment, Peter B., was to really underscore that before we even get to the first vote cast, we have a profoundly undemocratic, unfair system that is penalizing alternative voices, poor people, and people of color. So now let's actually go to the election day itself. One thing that we do know from all three of the attempted recounts in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania is that we cannot have confidence in these reported results. Mm-hmm. And in every state, I can give you evidence of the fact that there is too much suspicion associated with that. Remember that in Michigan, over 2,000 volunteers completed in-person trainings across the state in order to participate. And all voting in Michigan is done through optical scan ballots, which are prone to problems and errors. And again, you can go to jill2016.com and you can see a report of just how bad optical scan ballots can be. In addition to that, there are computer scientists, specifically Alex Halderman at the University of Michigan, ironically, who has been warning about the vulnerabilities of these exact machines, including the fact that they can be breached without detection and have a tendency to misread the markings. In Michigan, as you said, there were over 75,000 undercount tallies. Now, that is every political scientist I've talked to, Peter B., said that is far higher than any prediction would have. There are always some, right? Whether you call them undervotes or under tallies, but there are always some. But this number was far higher than any statistician said it should have been predicted or objectively had ever actually happened in the past. So that alone causes concern. then you have to remember that in Michigan, we never actually got the recount because the Republican-controlled Michigan Supreme Court literally stopped us just as we actually began. And in addition to that, what we began to see as we began the recounts, because we did get a chance to get started, was the incredible problems associated in, again, the communities of color around Detroit, around Ann Arbor, which mm-hmm. happens to be a college town,
sure,
and in Flint, again, another low-income place. So the fact that we never were able to do the recount that we paid for because it was actually stopped by a hyper-partisan Republican Supreme Court in Michigan, when we have all of this anecdotal evidence of problems. And then when we first began to actually do a recount, we began to see problems, but I can't give you the level that I can in Pennsylvania or Wisconsin, because it was actually stopped by, again, the Republican-controlled Supreme Court.
And I like to mispronounce the name of Michigan's Attorney General, Bill Schitte, because he was, of course, the driver of that bus to stop your efforts. And David, let me just give you one more snapshot of the voter suppression. I happened to be in Cincinnati, where I was born, on the weekend before the election. And I went to the single polling place that was open on the Sunday for early voting, which is the preference of many African-American voters. They go to church, they take a van, they go to vote. The lines were extending for blocks because the Attorney General of Ohio had or the Secretary of State, pardon me, had specified that there could only be one polling place per county. Now, there are more than a million people in Hamilton County, and not all of them vote early, but those who chose to ended up facing long lines, 3.5-4 hours to vote. And I went and interviewed people who were at the end of that line, many of whom peeled off and said, I'm not going to be able to vote today, and I got to work on Tuesday. And so that voter suppression, which was so visible to me in Cincinnati, is now treated by forensic analysts as low turnout by African Americans. And certainly there wasn't the historic turnout that Obama enjoyed among black voters. But I believe that many of those who are now considered to have been not voting were blocked from voting. It was not their intent not to vote.
Again, that is a completely reasonable conclusion to draw based on the objective evidence. And remember that allocation of these voting machines is actually done by election administrators. And in this country, we have partisan election administration, which is crazy. If you were playing in a softball league like I do, and you were to show up to play, you know, your rival that you are like really like, you know, the ones that we are most concerned about, and you showed up and they said, okay, on this game, we are supplying the referees, the umpires are completely the people that we are bringing, that we're paid for, they're on our payroll, you would not play that game, right? Mm-hmm. You would simply say, we can't do that. That's ridiculous. But yet that's what we do with election administration in this country. And the use of something as innocuous seeming as allocation of voting machines is the reason that I sound like a broken record, but in people of color districts and college districts, young people that historically and traditionally are anti-corporate voters, those districts and those precincts get far fewer machines than do the wealthy, mostly white suburban districts, which is why when you take a look objectively, you find typically the wait line in a poor or person of color precinct is usually hours as opposed to minutes in the traditionally white suburban districts. Again, one more example of the fact that we have a real problem. And again, that's just Michigan, where we never really got a chance to go deep to actually take a look at it. when we go to Wisconsin, which I'd like to shift to for just a moment.
Go ahead.
Where we attempted a recount. We did count more ballots there, but I do want to point out that the 51 or of the counties, we asked for a hand recount. Unfortunately, of the 72 counties, we only got about 50 of them hand counted. The judge, the Wisconsin judge who heard the case, said, and this is a paraphrase, but said, "I cannot under law mandate a hand count, but I implore and plead with election administrators across Wisconsin to confirm the integrity of our election results by doing a hand count." And in the counties that did the hand count only accounted for about 52% of the ballots cast. So for almost half of the counties, we did not actually get a hand count. So that's a problem. But in addition to that, the information that we actually got out of this is that we learned that it is possible to tamper with voting machines without disturbing others. And you know, the fact is that the system actually has voting machines, some of which come equipped with built-in programming. Now, the reality is that that kind of software is susceptible to being hacked. Again, I want to be clear. I'm not saying that we have evidence of a hacking. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is, why in the world would we use a system where computer experts tell us these systems are susceptible to hacking? Oh, and by the way, again, in laboratory settings, Professor Alex Halderman has literally manipulated the results of the machines of both the optical scans and the DREs, or so-called black box voting machines, that I've just described. So what we're talking about is an election system that election security professionals have identified as at best problematic. Now, so we know remote tampering is possible, but we just don't know if it happened or not. And remember, Peter B., as you know, I'm a lawyer by training. The absence of proof is not the proof of absence, right?
Indeed.
This is a real problem here, because we can literally prove to you that these machines are capable of being hacked. And this is the reason that I'm concerned. The second thing I want to say is, even though we only got a chance to hand count in about 50%, just over 50% of the states, what we found were actually literally thousands, and I think that the number came up to be about 70,000 votes that were in fact incorrectly tabulated. Now, some people say, ah, well, it doesn't matter because the net gain and the net change ended up being about the same. But Peter B., that's nuts. It's like, no, actually, we don't, that's an inappropriately high number of errors. And the fact that the errors one time helped one candidate and one time helped the other so that it balanced out at the end, that does not give me any confidence in the results. This just tells me that we're at, like, it does say, okay, well, in those particular counties, then perhaps, that's not circumstantial evidence of tampering by any particular candidate. But I now want to circle back to this, Peter B. Remember I told you that in just under half, we did not get hand counts? It was every one of the counties with super high Trump results mm-hmm. that we did not get the hand count. And by the way, in over a dozen of those counties, part of the reason that Wisconsin was identified by the security experts as needing a recount was because of two reasons. One, the polling results did not actually represent the actual results that were
Exit polls, you mean?
I'm sorry, the exit polling mm-hmm. results did not match the reported results, right?
Correct.
And remember that in foreign countries, the U.S. literally uses that as a mechanism to determine whether you can have confidence in the reported results or whether or not the elections are fraudulent or not. In addition to that, which is, again, a very high bit of circumstantial evidence. You also had the fact that in those counties, there were much higher reported voting than there had ever been. Now, okay, maybe people were really just super excited about this election and voted at higher margins. But the spike that happens in those counties that Trump won is another example of circumstantial evidence. Again, I am not saying that we know, like I can tell you with confidence that 2004, those results are almost surely fraudulent.
Yeah.
I can't tell you that in the 2016 election, but what I can tell you is we cannot trust the results. We don't know who won the election.
David, let me just state that I have great admiration for you and Dave Berman and other activists in Humboldt County. And I believe that you have some of the most transparent election processes that we see anywhere in the country. You got a great registrar of voters who voluntarily audits different precincts, and it is a very transparent process. I want to zoom out for a minute, though, and kind of cobble together what you were just talking about. And my basic question is, you know, why don't the Democrats fight when an election is stolen or potentially stolen? In 2000, they bungled the Florida recount, betting on a partial recount instead of a statewide, and then the Supreme Court intervened and stopped the count. Gore won. That has been established from the forensic analysis. You and I agree that the 2004 election was stolen in Ohio, and that John Kerry actually won Ohio by more than 150,000 votes, a swing of a quarter million from the nominal reported vote to the analytical vote after the count. Then we fast forward to 2016, and I take your point that we don't have enough evidence to declare this a stolen election. But we have the Obama team and the Clinton campaign team agreeing before the election that Russia was meddling. They believe that narrative. Then Trump is declared the winner, and they don't lift a finger to try to challenge that. There were no lawsuits. They only begrudgingly observed your activities in the three states that you've mentioned. They did not use the Electoral College. They didn't even, you know, make any kind of a fuss at the final January certification of the presidential vote in the United States Senate. So they didn't make any legal or other effort to try to stop this, and they claim that a foreign government that is hostile to our interests intervened and manipulated the election, when you and I have just spent more than 20 minutes here enumerating how it was gamed by people inside the United States. And so that's one of the reasons that I remain skeptical of the Democratic advance narrative that Russia interfered in the election, because they didn't do diddly to respond to it.
And in fact, what, again, let's remember that we, at least I will assert, I believe that the reason that the Democratic Party machine and their echo chambers in the corporate media are advancing the Russia narrative is for two reasons. One, to prevent anyone looking deeper at the actual DNC leaks that we already described. But the second one is to prevent folks from asking the hard question, how the hell could any candidate lose to Donald Trump, right? I mean, the horrible campaign that Hillary Clinton ran, and I don't just mean like poor television ad buys. I mean here's an interesting note. Hillary Clinton was the first presidential campaign in modern history not to visit the swing state of Wisconsin. Interesting, right? But even deeper than that, I submit to you that the neoliberal agenda that Hillary Clinton represented and NAFTA, her creation of the privatized criminal justice system and the creation really of the prison industrial complex, her opposition to single payer health care, the fact that she sits on or once sat on the board of directors for Walmart Corporation, her incredible hostility to organized labor, the fact that she was getting hundreds of thousands of dollars to simply come and give speeches at Goldman Sachs. And when we got our hands on some of the transcripts, literally acknowledging that anything that I say in public, you don't have to worry about because that's just what I tell the voters, because you have to have a public position and the actual position that I'm willing to tell you, my funders. You know, you add all these things together, and it's no wonder that that some of the exit polling questions that I found most interesting were, for the first time in the history of elections, at least since there's any polling data, we know with certainty half of the people casting votes were actually voting against the other party's candidate. That's the first time that's ever happened, Peter B. I mean, like, literally people were absolutely disgusted by both Trump and Clinton. And remember, at a time when for many of us, we believe this was such a critical election. And remember, I voted for and actively supported Stein Baraka. But at a time when we're watching neoliberalism morph into neo-fascism, this election, which was in fact so important, once again, just under half of the people who were registered to vote did not bother to vote. That does not include the number who could have and qualified to register to vote but didn't even bother. The reality is that Hillary Clinton ran what is historically probably the absolute worst campaign for the Times that could have been written. I can't tell you the number of people anecdotally who have said to me, you know, I would have voted for Bernie Sanders if he was the Democrat, but I can't stomach Hillary Clinton, and they ended up voting for Donald Trump. And some of these people I'm related to. I've got cousins, yep. Right?
Me too.
Told me that. And so they look me in the eye, and I guess what I'm getting at is, Peter B., I know it's just anecdotal, but I believe them.
Well, David, I came to the same conclusion. I went to the Midwest last summer, and people in my extended family who have always at least held their noses and voted for the Democrat said, I can't do it. And then there were those who were actively, you know, in tune with Trump. But in early August, I became what I think is one of the few lefty commentators in America who predicted that Trump would win. I made a $5 wager with Thomas Frank, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas and more recently Listen Liberal. And I'm not, you know, trying to pat myself on the back here, but I recognize that Hillary had no room to grow and that people had ideas set in concrete about her. They were either a woman who, you know, felt she was entitled to be president, or people who just simply had deep opposition to her based on the issues. There was a misogynist element, but I think it was relatively minor as compared to her political positions. And so it did not surprise me that Trump was named the winner after this very corrupt and questionable election process that ended in November.
I'm glad you said proclaimed the winner, because I don't want to let go of the fact that we cannot have confidence in these reported results, even as I join you and I wish others would engage in the scathing indictment of the campaign that Hillary Clinton ran. And again, to remind you that we began this part of our conversation as my belief that that's the reason Russia, Russia, Russia. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason for this corporate narrative, again, for which there is literally no objective hard evidence, is an effort to dissuade us from looking at and asking, why did Hillary Clinton lose this election? And number two, how in the world did Hillary Clinton actually beat Bernie Sanders? Because that, in fact, was tainted.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, we covered that in detail, and the tactics, some of which were used against Hillary in the general election, were used against Bernie in the primary. And there were at least a dozen states where the exit polls showed gross anomalies to the official result. David, we could spend all day talking about 2016. I certainly enjoy this, but I respect you as a visionary, and you're not just folding up your tent and kicking back and enjoying a summer in the Redwoods there. You're on the road this summer, and you're holding workshops to help educate people and train them in some of the progressive tactics that you have used effectively over the years. And first, I want to put out that August 2nd through the 6th, you're participating in the Democracy Convention in Minneapolis. And then August 12th and 13th, you'll be holding the Movement School in Phoenix, Arizona, where there's a whole group of activists, John Brakey and others, who've worked on election integrity over the years. And it is a red state, with a whole lot of challenges for progressives. And I want to send people to your website, but I came up with melfig.wixsite.com. What is the best address for people to find you?
Really, the best place for now, because we're literally that's a prototype website, and that's the reason it's such a horrible URL. So folks should hit me up on Facebook, and if you're not on Facebook, just go to my Facebook page, because we'll put that there.
And that's David K. Cobb on Facebook.
David Keith Cobb, K-E-I-T-H, middle name.
Okay.
Unfortunately, at this point, this is such fast-breaking information, Peter B., that I don't have a good website for you.
Okay, but I will be able to link to this URL, and people can just click on that. It'll be in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Go ahead, David.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. And I'm very proud, because what we're talking about, these Movement Schools for Revolutionaries, is a day-long custom-designed workshop for people who self-identify as revolutionaries and who acknowledge, as I do and I think you do, that we must participate actively in electoral politics. I want to stop for a moment, because the word revolutionary is intentionally provocative, right? I want to be clear. I'm a revolutionary because I want to restructure society. I believe the current social, political, and economic institutions of this country are fundamentally racist, sexist, and class oppressive, and the huge transnational corporations are going to destroy the planet that we depend upon for life itself if we do not stop it. Now, that being the case, I'm a revolutionary, and so is anybody who wants to restructure society. But I am also a nonviolent revolutionary. I am absolutely committed to engaging the electoral process as a way of nonviolent revolution, because I do not believe in using guns or weapons or violence as an affirmative political tactic. So, you don't have to be a Green. You don't have to be a Democrat. Your party label does not matter. If you believe that we need to restructure society and that elections should be engaged in an authentic manner to try to create that society, then we welcome you, because we know that there are solutions to every problem that the world faces, but they're not being implemented because we, the people, do not actually control our own government. What's really exciting is that what we're finding is at the local level, we're able to actually do things that actually make people's lives tangibly better. The election integrity project that we did in Humboldt County, again, because we had a fantastic voter registrar, but also because we had citizen activists, we literally created a process where we're not just auditing the results. Literally, in Humboldt County, a scanned version of every ballot is put online, so anybody who wants to take the time can literally do a full count to confirm the results. Oh, and by the way, we've already found problems that the election administrator actually went back and said, thank you, citizens. You were correct. We figured out why. It was a very minor technical problem, but it was a technical problem that the election administrator had not caught. Somebody else did. So I just want to point out, elections matter, right? And at the local level, they can really work well. But the Movement School itself, even though they're custom designed, depending upon who I'm partnering with, the basic arc remains the same. The goal is to help people understand the larger social and historical context of what is happening. And that is to say, we do a meta-context conversation about the reality of white supremacy, capitalism, imperialism, and patriarchy, and the culture in which we're living in. The next thing that we do, though, is to acknowledge that we are living in a moment of ecological, political, and economic crisis. And when you have crisis happening at so many different levels and sectors, this is what historians and anthropologists call collapse. We are literally living in a moment of the beginning of systemic collapse, which is creating what we call the current historical moment, what political scientists and others call historical conjuncture. And this is important because this has only happened a few times in U.S. history. And interestingly enough, one of them was around slavery. And when you saw the birth of the Republican Party as a so-called third party, ironically, of course, as an abolitionist political party, because the two existing parties, the Whigs and the Jefferson and the Democrat Republican, the Democratic Party and the Whig Party were both strong supporters and defenders of slavery. Right. All I'm getting at is understanding historical conjuncture in the historical political trajectory is showing us the collapse of consent around the neoliberal agenda and a rise of what I will call reactionary or fascist right wing and a third pole, which is still mostly undefined, but we can understand it as basically Bernie Sanders, Jill Stein, the progressive left that's basically pissed off but has not actually landed on exactly where to go or what to do. I'm going to stop there because I can go into detail on what else we do, but I want to give you a chance, Peter, on behalf of your listeners who might have some questions. The overall arc that I've laid out, is it making sense to you? Do you agree with it? Like, what do you think?
Well, it definitely makes sense to me. And where I want to go next, David, is to get your definition, contemporary definition of fascism. Because we are at a historic juncture, and I agree with you. And the forces that were, in my view, put in motion by Occupy and by Black Lives Matter to define the wealth and income disparities and the class and race issues that continue to fester in our society and culture, these are being completely ignored by those who took power this year. And they do so at their own peril. In my view, just like Egypt cannot ever suppress the Muslim Brotherhood, I don't believe that the oligarchs in the United States will ever successfully suppress the aspirations of the middle and lower class activists in this country. And I believe that this is our moment to demand changes not only in the obvious extremes represented by the Republicans, but in the go-along, get-along, corporate-financed Democratic Party, where Nancy Pelosi's brilliant strategies, and by the way, I once worked for Nancy, I consider her a friend, but I have for 2 years now been calling for her to retire and to stop running campaigns where the Democrats simply say, we don't suck as bad as the Republicans, vote for us. It doesn't work, it hasn't worked, and it's getting worse. And so this is a moment where I believe that activists who are not deeply aligned with any political party can make a big difference and build coalitions toward a meaningful third party or coalition effort to retake the Democratic Party in a way that will once again reflect the interests, the crying needs, and the aspirations of the rest of us.
Well, what a beautiful way that you both asked the question and then provided the context around it. I will define fascism, but I want to point out literally where I was going next was the whole point of these is to build a united front against fascism. So let me describe, look, Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator and philosopher. Remember, Mussolini was actually a deep thinker. And Mussolini famously said fascism, more appropriately, should be called corporatism, because it merges the economic might of our national corporations with the military might of our nation state, end quote. And remember, Peter B., Mussolini was a proud defender of fascism.
Indeed.
He was there, like, so he was proud. It merges the corporate state and the military state. And we are watching that happen before our very eyes under the Trump administration. It is beginning, but we call it neo-fascism because it's not exactly the same. There are differences. And it's also important to understand that it's a trajectory, because neoliberalism is evolving into neo-fascism. And it's not just that Clinton is so bad that it gave an opportunity for Trump, although that is true, but that doesn't tell the whole story, because the neoliberal agenda is actually about privatizing things that people once thought were and understood to be the public domain or the commons. It is the privatization of healthcare. It's the privatization of the criminal justice system. It's the privatization of water systems. It's the privatization of elections. It's the privatization of everything. And what naturally comes out of that, Peter B., is austerity. And the austerity is what pinches down even further on poor and working class people, who recognize that the ruling elites are the ones who cannot be trusted. And again, somebody like Trump, or frankly Bernie Sanders, who comes in as an outsider, is the reason that so many people looked to both of them and said, aha, somebody that we can trust because they're not part of this corrupt basic system. And I will make the case that if you take policy proposals out and just look at the meta context of both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, the similarity that is glaring is they are insurgent campaigns within the existing two-party system that were hated by the leadership of the two-party system, but that was getting momentum, energy, enthusiasm from the so-called base of those two. Because I'm going to tell you this, Peter B., principled liberals and progressives have been lied to and sold out by the ruling elite of the Democratic Party, who were taking their money and their marching orders from corporations, big banks, and Wall Street America. But there's a corollary to that statement, and that is this. Principled conservatives have been lied to and sold out by the ruling elite of the Republican Party, who are taking their money and their marching orders from the same damn corporations, Wall Street America, and big banks. So the fascism that we're talking about is actually a neo-fascism. And the united front that we're talking about is, how do we actually bring together the constituencies of organized labor, women, people of color, immigrants, poor white working class people into a genuine coalition that we can actually trust each other with? And again, and here's where I get in a lot of trouble by some folks, but I don't care what the name of that political formation is. You know, I'm not a sectarian Green Party member. I'm proud to be a Green Party member, and I can, you know, our commitment to peace, justice, democracy, and ecology. I've been a Green Party organizer since 1996. You know, my Green Party credentials, I think, should be beyond repute. However, I know this. A movement that's going to succeed is going to have to actually come together and be broad, deep, conscious, politically educated, and willing to disrupt the current system. And it must have an electoral arm of that system. So the electoral arm, I hope and suspect it will be the Green Party. But Peter B., maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that electoral arm ends up being another party that has not yet come into formation. Maybe, I don't think it's likely, but maybe those good people who are working to take over the Democratic Party succeed. And the Democratic Party becomes the place where genuine progressive populist policies can come forward. The point is, Peter B., I don't care what the name of that electoral arm is.
And I
know
this. I'm with you, David. I am not wedded to a political party. I was a Democrat, and I left there more than 20 years ago. And I'm proud to be independent, and I will support any group or coalition that will advance the issues I care most about. And if I may, one more friendly amendment attempt here, David. In your definition of neo-fascism, I would add the creeping police state.
Yes.
And the normalization of domestic surveillance on a massive level. And that's what led to the rolling up of Occupy. Obama used the organs that we were told were to defend us from dangerous foreign terrorists to silence First Amendment activists in this country. Similar things happened with the Standing Rock protest, and we're learning now about the unlicensed security contractor who was operating there with the dogs and the helicopters and all of these other tools of the militarized police state. And I believe that that component is one of the most virulent and dangerous, and it was a nominal progressive promoting change, a guy named Barack Obama, who took the temporary measures, we thought, of the Bush era and made them permanent. And
no, there's no doubt. And I appreciate your courage as a progressive of being willing to indict the Obama administration, because I say this. When anybody, an elected official, does something good, we should cheer. And when they don't, we should jeer, right? With a G, J, right? We cheer when they do something good, but we hold them accountable when they do something bad. And you are absolutely correct that the Obama administration's normalization, continuation, and deepening of the police state. And you're absolutely right. If you look at what information we do know about the use of the Department of Homeland Security to target Occupy is chilling. And again, not only was it under Barack Obama, but it happened after the Democratic Party operatives tried to come in and take it over the way the Republicans successfully took over the Tea Party to turn it into their arm. It was, in one sense, to the credit of Occupy Wall Street, that they refused to knuckle under and simply become Democratic Party troops that the Obama administration felt obliged and compelled then to dismantle those encampments, which were everywhere peaceful and nothing more than people gathering to exercise their First Amendment rights to peaceably assemble. In addition to that, I think it's important that we recognize that it is heightening under Donald Trump. So as bad as Obama was, in this respect, Trump is worse. There's no doubt about it. And we are seeing the normalization of a genuine fascist groupings that are coming up. In fact, we've even been taught to call them the alt-right rather than fascists. But they are, in fact, fascists. I mean, you know, Richard Spencer and what he represents and the explicit white supremacist approach to demonizing immigrants and people of color and Muslims is beyond chilling. They talk about the, quote, day of the rope on online chat groups that anybody who even just takes a look at, you can learn about. And that's basically a thinly veiled shorthand for their thinking of Kristallnacht. They want to kill people like not only black and brown and Muslims, but frankly, Peter B., people like you and me. They believe us to be traitors to their vision of how America is supposed to go. So what I'm getting at is when we talk about the neo-fascism of today, the corporatization and the merger of the corporate state and the military state. And as you properly talked about getting us into a conversation and acknowledging around the military state and the domestic spying that is being used by the state apparatus. And in addition to that, the creation organically of a kind of new brown shirts that are emerging. You know, the number of attacks that we're seeing on college campuses, that we are seeing on mosques, that we are seeing on immigrants' communities. Peter B., this is like we've never seen this since the 1930s. I mean, it really is important to recognize. And one of the things that we do in these movement schools for revolutionaries is to actually track them. And I want to lift up Morris Dees in the Southern Poverty Law Center. If anything that I've been saying in the last 5 minutes or so is really causing you concern or you want to learn more, we use them as a resource and encourage others to do that. They are at the cutting edge of tracking these sorts of things. So when we say that neo-fascism is emerging in this country, we use that language very carefully, and then we explain it's not just rhetoric. It's not just a way to get people to shake their fists. It is a way to understand this historic moment and how profoundly dangerous it is, but also the incredible opening that this moment of conjuncture gives us.
David, do you have any ideas on how we on the left can deal with the so-called Antifa? These are self-styled black bloc activists, and, you know, we've seen this in Berkeley twice in the last 6 months, the Milo Yiannopoulos and also just the Trump supporters who staged a march there. And it's a handful of people who use anarchist tactics. And they end up becoming foils that discredit those of us who are nonviolent and who are pressing a very important anti-fascist agenda. How can we deal with this? Because we end up compromised by the media coverage that will highlight the bad boys and not really recognize the mainstream progressives or, you know, the nonviolent ones who have a very strong point of view and are pressing it.
Yes. So I guess that's a deep question, and I'm glad that you asked it. I want to break it down. Right. Because before we get I guess what I want to say is this. If the choice, and I think it's a false choice, but if the choice is between anti-fascist and fascist, I will choose anti-fascist every time. Right. So interrupting that narrative that the only thing there is either the Antifa movement or the fascist is something that I try to do every time. And it is why I encourage all of us to engage in everyday anti-fascism. And what that means is to interrupt conversations that you hear that are homophobic or racist or xenophobic or otherwise bashing others, whether it's passing off as, quote, just a joke or it is, you know, too many of us have allowed ourselves to be silent when we hear such a thing because we don't want to interrupt that we don't want to be seen as stopping free speech or we value the relationship of somebody who's telling a racist joke and so forth. So to me, the important thing to do is to engage in everyday anti-fascism and actually talk about the fact that, hey, you know, a racist joke is actually creating the seeds for these kind of thugs that are actually killing people. And by the way, in Portland, Oregon, literally one of those people stabbed somebody coming to the defense of a Muslim woman who is being harassed. See, everyday fascism is important, Peter, because it says these are our cultural norms. We actually do not allow the seeds of the fascists to take root within our communities. The second thing that we have to do is to recognize that the real solution is actually to create policies that actually are able to put people to work in meaningful and productive ways. Again, you mentioned Thomas Frank and Listen Liberal. You know, the reality is that there are policies that could be done right now that my cousins would feel really good about and would prevent folks from actually looking to the fascist element. The second thing that I really want to point out around the Antifa movement is that we never know how many of them are agent provocateurs or otherwise saboteurs. I am reminded of the photograph that I saw back in 1999 during the WTO protests of a black box, a purported to be a black box protester breaking a Starbucks window, and there was the photo, And then it, using digital technology, when you zoom in, that protester was wearing a brand new set of Nike sneakers. Now, you might think for the casual person, that's like, so what? But what I know, and I suspect you know, Peter B., is that no black box person is going to be wearing brand new from the store Nike sneakers. Nike is one of the absolute targets of these folks. You know, Nike was one of the sort of poster child for the entire WTO protests. So I guarantee you, and again, I have nothing more than that photograph as evidence, yeah. But I guarantee you that evidence is enough to tell me at least that person was an agent provocateur.
I'll trade you another image from the WTO protests. I was there observing a line of riot gear equipped police. There were 50 of them across the street, and half a block away at the Nike store, there were two guys who had climbed up over the door front. And they were busy ripping down the N, the I, the K, and the E. And not a single cop moved to stop them. There was no challenge to the line that they had drawn. There were some who weren't participating in the line, who were just standing around. And nobody made any effort to stop them from tearing down the Nike letters. And so we always must be suspicious, particularly of people who won't show their faces, that they could be working for the government.
Or by some quasi-government agency, or by one of these, remember, an agent provocateur need not be a government spy. It actually could be Richard Spencer and his group. If you take a look at the, again, go to Morris D's website, Southern Poverty Law Center, and they track all sorts of groups, and they literally online are training how to provoke nonviolent protesters into action. And one of the techniques that they recommend is exactly that, to be an agent provocateur, to actually, because they know that they can win the media narrative if they do so.
Right.
I know we're running out of time, Peter B., so I would be make a mistake if I did not say, in these movement schools for revolutionaries, we actually do end with what can we do? Because we do hands-on, locally grounded strategic planning where folks can roll up their sleeves, identify specific electoral objectives and goals in their community, how progressive forces can unite across political parties and organizations and constituencies to actually win elections. And we lift up examples like the Richmond Progressive Alliance, who I know you know very well, mm-hmm. But also Jackson, Mississippi, the heart of the old Confederacy, now the Cooperation Jackson and the Lumumba Center, and Antar Lumumba has now been elected mayor of Jackson. We lift up Progressive Dane in Madison, Wisconsin. We're on the Isthmus. They are actually winning local election where Greens and Progressive Democrats and Socialists are actually working together. The point I'm making, Peter B., is we have a theoretical understanding of what is happening and why. We actually have a suggested plan, and better, we have concrete examples of what other folks are doing successfully that can be replicated. These movement schools are a serious effort to say we have to unite and fight, build a united front of both against fascism, but for the progressive values that I know you and I suspect your podcast listeners share.
Well, David Cobb, it's a pleasure to spend time with you. You mentioned the Richmond Alliance. Let me just tag that for listeners. If you go to peterbcollins.com and enter Steve Early in the search window, Steve wrote the book about the Richmond remarkable changes there, taking on Chevron and winning. And so we do have a lot to build on. And I am very pleased at your vision and your enthusiasm. It's infectious, David. So I want to remind listeners, Minneapolis at the Democracy Convention, August 2nd through the 6th, and then the weekend of August 12th, the Movement School in Phoenix, Arizona. Again, there's a link in the show file for this podcast for you to get more information. David Cobb, keep fighting.
Thank you so much, Peter B. I hope I can come back on again.
You bet. Thanks for listening to my in-depth interview with David Cobb. I'd love your reaction. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails. to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.